Laura and Diane and I and several others from the Sangha are taking a course in the middle-length discourses offered by the Sati Center in Redwood City, Gil Fransdal's Buddhist Studies Center. And it's a 12-week course, and we're reading, I don't know, somewhere between 4 and 7, 8 suttas a week and sort of working through it. And it's really a lot of the core teachings. So the first couple weeks were really intriguing to me in terms of how we study and practice here, because it was setting the groundwork for the entire 12 weeks of the course by asking the question, well, how do you actually learn and know that what you're learning about is true and that it works? So I thought I would, it kind of inspired me into tonight's topic. And for those of you that saw the e-news, the title of it was Holding the Snake. There's this very famous simile that the Buddha gave about holding a snake, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But really I wanted to start at the very, very basic level, and that is to acknowledge right from the beginning that this word truth may be fairly loaded for some of you. In some senses, many of us sort of shy away from truth with a big T. You know? I mean, we're searching for this, what works, and we're searching for some level of relief from suffering. But ultimately, this practice, at least in my view, is about some kind of freedom, right? Achieving some kind of freedom. So, those of you that have been scarred by conventional religions may view this word truth with a big T as being this thing out there that you have to believe in, okay? This abstract thing way off here somewhere. And I just want to say at the outset that that's not the context I'm going to be using the word truth in at all. We'll get into the Pali roots and all of that in a little bit here. But just so I don't have anybody running or screaming from the door before we even have a chance to get started, I wanted to lay down that. Now, as you know, particularly in the Mahayana tradition, there is this idea of the two truths, the absolute truth, the ultimate, whatever you want to call it, and then the relative truth that we, the relative world that we all live in every day. And so there's also that undercurrent and that potential for confusion. Before Diane and Jeff and I started our sitting in this seat as community mentors, Dennis, who's running our training program, brought in John Travis to just talk to us about teaching. One thing I really distinctly remember from that conversation is that John said, the easiest way to get into trouble is to approach an absolute truth issue from a relative viewpoint, or a relative truth issue from an absolute viewpoint. So we don't want to get those two confused, because they're kind of parallel universes. They aren't mutually exclusive, but if you think you're in one realm and you're actually in the other, you're going to get into trouble. So with that background, and a little nod to Honest Abe, whose birthday is today, and who I'm sure could give us many teachings of wisdom about truth, Abe Lincoln. We'll just launch into this. And I want to do that with just a little question and answer period to set the stage for why are we even reading anything. Or why are we practicing? So every couple of months I like to come in here and I like to ask everybody, why are we even doing this? Why are we here? Why do we practice? What's it all about? Anybody brave enough or foolish enough to try and answer to that one? There's no right answer, don't worry. I'm not. No gold stars here. Or
from a personal point of view, I'm practicing to be happy.
Mm-hmm. You look happy.
To find happiness, maybe. Huh.
I've always been driven to understand, I mean, just this word truth again, but sort of to see where I'm looking through a filter versus like actually seeing the world more clearly. Mm-hmm. So trying to make that distinction in this practice is very helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. Could everyone hear that in the back?
No.
She was saying that, getting back to this concept of truth, she's looking for what that is for her and the ability to actually see things clearly the way they are. Paraphrased. Yes?
Tried as it may sound, what is the meaning of life? Who am I?
I was drawn to the practice to really get a handle on some suffering, real emotional and physical suffering, and you know, it's really developed into a lot of different things. You know, it's gotten its little tentacles into everything since. Over the years, but that's how it started for me.
So, I used to start out, when I first started out, I thought truth and reality, that was my big deal, truth and reality. And then nobody could ever define any of that for me, so I'm now, the teachings just provide clarity for the experiences happening in my life. And so that's why I'm doing this. That's why I continue to meditate and do a little study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons. One, I think a certain degree of freedom from suffering and seeing that kind of increasing over time. On another level, I think just almost an intuitive feeling of like being home or this is bad for me. Kind of having that just in the knowing. And then the third thing is I find that for me the spiritual search really gives a certain meaning to life that maybe in my early 20s it just felt kind of meaningless. And I remember talking to a friend saying that in some ways the spiritual life didn't really solve my problems, but it answered a lot of my questions. I really kind of feel that way, and maybe down the line that will change, but they're kind of like the three reasons for me.
So I'm doing it to lessen my suffering, and also really to be able to be a force for good, because I feel like it helps me know what the right thing to do is in a given situation, what the right thing to do is, the right thing to say. So that helps lessen the suffering of others.
Great. Thank you.
I remember you asked that question a few years ago, and I said, I'm here to meet a man. And it's like, okay, I'm sure here to meet a man, but also to be okay if that doesn't happen.
Would you like me to say your name on the tape?
to get some level of equanimity no matter what.
Thank you. So, my next question is, and this was alluded to in one of the shares, for you, how do your practice, which you're obviously all practicing to some level because you're here, and study interrelate? Do you do any at all? Do you wish you could but don't quite know how to approach it? Is there some component of studying or reading or something that informs your, in some way interrelates with your practice? How do you, for you, how does study interrelate with practice, both formal and in daily life?
I mean, study is definitely a component of my practice. And when I started here, I was trying to read all the books that everybody recommended and listen to all the Dharma talks, and I was getting really, really frustrated. I'd hear this, I'd hear that, and I'll never get anywhere. And so, I do study, but I try to not make that a major component of my practice. I don't know if I could give a percentage or something like that, but I'm reading a couple of books, talking to people and listening to a few Dharma talks, but doing more meditation.
Thanks.
I find that there are some texts that I go to and I assimilate them like they're already a part of me,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll let them rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll see what really makes sense. And anything that does just kind of becomes more. And anything that I don't grasp won't necessarily be there. Maybe it will in the future. But mm-hmm. I like the, over time we find what really comes to us. And some things feel like we've come across them before,
mm-hmm.
like they're, very alive.
Right. Yeah, that's a great attitude of, well, maybe it's, I read this, but maybe it's not working for me now, but at some point in the future, leaving that door open and realizing that some things are speaking to me now because of where my practice is at the present moment. Thank you.
Well, I just find the reading, that it nourishes my practice, it inspires it,
mm-hmm.
It's comforting, and it's like, oh yeah, it just feels so true. And how wonderful that this person could articulate it. And
mm-hmm.
It's very rich, enriching.
Yeah.
What I do for studying is just read. There's just certain books that I read, and then just attending Dharma talks. And I feel like sitting meditation and doing that reading and listening to the talks, they just complement each other so well. I feel like either one on its own just wouldn't really do it. And what I feel it does is that together, I feel like it just changes the way I see things. I just basically the things that I've read again and again, I just see things through that lens. And it's, I feel like it's the combination of the practice and the study that really makes that happen.
I'm going to Heather's committed student group up in Nevada City, and she has a very sort of formal outline with reading, and then you have phone interviews and suggested meditation and daily life work. And for me, that's really helpful because it's very structured, and then being able to actually talk to a teacher. And so that, and then coming here is what I've been doing, which I find very, very helpful.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Hearing that, or before I heard that, I was just thinking that one thing that I spend time doing, it's what I call exercises that I'll get from something that a teacher said and or that they have recommended for me. And so it's really putting it, what she was saying, bring it into daily life, mm-hmm. to what you've read, what's been recommended to you, or something like that. And there's a lot more of that now than when I started. It was just reading and coming here and meditating.
Mm-hmm. See a hand down here somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, I find that the study and meditation complement each other in the sense that if I just were reading stuff, I would stay in my head, and if I were just meditating, my mind would start to, you know, be critical, why am I doing this or whatever, so that it would be able to work together. If this is one or the other, they wouldn't work as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, pretty much one informs the other. And the other informs the one. And so I mean, that's, I'm hearing that a lot here. But the other thing that, I don't do a lot of study. I don't do a lot of really intense reading. I do read Buddha books pretty consistently. But I can't say that I honestly study them. But my study over this past several years has been working in the community. Working in the Sangha, doing some volunteer work, you know, helping the board out, participating in activities, and of course going to the Dharma, to the day longs and the sittings and stuff. But working with meditators in Dharma communities, that's a huge learning. To kind of hear their motivation and be around them and see how they act and hear the same things that you're hearing here every Thursday night from our teachers, you know. So I think that's like a huge part of my study, you know, okay. Just working in the community.
Good. Yes.
Now, what's been very helpful for me is that I think what's drawn me to this is just curiosity and reading. I mean, I was an academic, so of course I did a lot of reading, but reading is more now, not so much for the facts there, but where to focus that curiosity. That's where the thoughts been helpful.
All right. Thank you.
I had one of my very best insights studying. I was reading a book that was recommended to us when we took the introductory class. And I had read it 3 or 4 times, and I just was reading this paragraph, and it just flowed over me, this realization, this just tremendous awareness, which kind of surprised me, because before, when I've had, really important insights, they've happened more at retreats. Long term, you know, day after day meditating, and so I study regularly, and I also found that last year when I was going through the first year after my husband's death, I read a lot of things that Dennis had given us, and they were just tremendously helpful, not only in dealing with my grief, but in meditating at that time. I mean, they just fit together just beautifully.
Thank you.
So, everybody kind of has different, varying degrees of the same thing, but, it keeps coming up with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the three of them together, and how I know that when I'm studying the suttas, it's really calming to me. I can go, I think it's one of the only things that truly calms my agitated mind, if I'm ruminating or really upset, and don't typically get to that ruminating point, but recently it's been a challenge, and I go into, in the Buddha's words, and I can spend a couple of minutes in there, and it really just washes away the anxiety. I mean, it's really phenomenal. So I keep going back. It's just good.
couple of other aspects that I've experienced are, I experience taking on study as another way of taking responsibility for my practice, as opposed to simply having it digested by others. I really have to rely on teachers and people who have walked the path, you know, longer and more deeply, for a lot of instruction, suggestion, but then to start looking at some of the same materials and some of the same sources and to actually make myself try to understand them with this mind feels like a form of engaging more deeply and taking responsibility.
Great. So that actually leads us into a little exercise I'd like to do. And that's, you know, we take this stuff in, but then how do we actually verify for ourselves, you know, what's useful and what's true? So one of Gill's introductory essays described three different ways that in the Buddha's time, three different styles of how to approach religious teaching or truths. And he puts it in quotes, truths. The first was the belief in texts. And, you know, not surprisingly, the Brahmins or the priest caste of the dominant culture was responsible for preserving the ancient Vedic texts, so that was their favorite, that was their favorite method. But, you know, think about it. In our society, those are the book Buddhists. Those are the folks that, you know, read the Buddhist books, and they may or may not practice, and certainly know plenty of people, you know, outside Sim that tell me they read a lot of Buddhist books, but they really don't practice at all. They just like reading them. The second were those renunciate groups. As you know, there are all these different religious movements going on in India at this time. Those renunciate groups that started to appear approximately a century or two before the Buddha, who believed the truth could be found through reasoning and conjecture. You know, that sounds pretty familiar, right? Got our scientific method. If it doesn't pass our rational test, forget it, it's out the door. You know, that sort of approach. Third were a different group of renunciates who considered personal and direct experience to be a way to definitely know the truth. So my question for you, so we'll just kind of summarize it up here. Your question for discussion is not that any of us do any of these exclusively. So the way I want to frame the question for the next discussion is that we have these three modes, and in each of us they're going to be present in different amounts, you know, not only in any given moment, but then as time progresses, as many of you have said, it sort of shifts and changes. You may come to the practice and only sit for, you know, 5 years, and then all of a sudden, well, maybe some reading of the text would be helpful, or maybe some reading of secondary sources. You start out there, and then eventually you go to the suttas themselves. In other cases, you might, as we said before, you know, you might be a person that's just never done anything but read the text, and all of a sudden you decide to actually try out meditating and that. And then, you know, there's this reasoning piece about how do you deal with some of the more metaphysical aspects that are in the suttas and that sort of thing. And when you're listening to a speaker, are you, you know, kind of analytically evaluating what they're saying as it goes and that sort of thing? Or are you weighing it against your own experience? So there's this mix for all of us. And what I'd like you to do is break into threes or fours and discuss with each other how this mix works for you. Start with present moment, but if you need to... you know, if it's important to the discussion to bring about how it's changed for you over time, feel free to do that as well. And we'll take about 6 minutes for that.
Question before we start?
Yes, please.
Under reasoning,
yeah.
Would you put contemplation or reflection in that category? I mean, I can sort of see it there and in three.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this thing called reflective acceptance. We'll talk about. There's a method, one of the methods that the Buddha talks about in these suttas on how do you discover the truth. That's called reflective acceptance. So that would be here. Yeah. Okay. 5-6 minutes. Groups of 3s to 4. So can we have a couple of the groups report out? What surprised you? Was there a consensus?
There was no consensus in our group.
No consensus.
Very different impression. Almost in all 4 camps. Yeah.
Interesting.
We found we're all good speakers.
Great.
I guess the consensus would be that whatever you were focusing most on, it all works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're certainly not exclusive, are they?
No.
Yeah. Well, you might hold that as an open question for the next week or so for yourself. Kind of fun sometimes to let it kind of run in the background, let a question run in the background, and especially one that you maybe not have thought about before. Just kind of let it run and see what shows up in the next week or so. Yeah?
And please jump in. I just wanted to say one thing that I think that we all kind of agreed that there was kind of an evolution in our practice. You know, when we started, we might have read more, and then we were moving. We thought that all of them are important, but different proportions of our time are going to, you know, different activity.
Great.
That.
Thank you. All right. Now we have the background to discuss the simile of the snake. So there was this monk in the Sangha that had wrong view. He was way off base about something. And the Buddha, the monks tried to work with him, and they couldn't convince him that his view was not wrong. He was holding to it. So they went to the Buddha, and he said, tell him to come over here, I want to talk to him. So he did that. They brought him over, and he said, suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and caught it rightly with a cleft stick. And having done so, grasped it rightly by the neck. Then, although the snake might wrap its coils around his hand or his arm or his limbs, still he would not come to death or deadly suffering because of that. Why is that? Because of his right grasp of the snake. Then he makes the opposite case. Poisonous snake, grab it by the tail. You have the wrong grasp of the snake, and you're going to do a lot of harm to yourself and possibly others because of your wrong grasp of the snake. What he's talking about here is the right grasp of the teachings that can actually do harm if we hold those teachings in the wrong way. Having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Okay. So there are... and there's another really interesting... I mean, Majjhima Nikaya 22 is amazing. I've done a whole deal here where we just talked about that one. There's so much in it that we can't get into all of it. But he says something interesting after he gives them those two similes. He says, therefore, bhikkhus, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then either ask me about it or those bhikkhus who are wise. So that curiosity, that inquiry, it's got to be there. And that requires some discernment, right? That requires knowing if you understand it or not. If you don't understand it, You need to either do what was suggested earlier of figuring, hey, that's just not where I am right now. I need to set that aside, get back to it later in my practice or later in the day when I'm feeling better, whatever it might be. But at the same time, being willing and able, actually take some discernment, able to realize, I don't really grasp that teaching. There's a lot more there I don't get. I need to go to somebody that can help me understand this. So that's a recommendation to you. Just keep that curiosity alive as you do reading and study, and be willing and able, you know, develop your discernment so that you can tell when you do or do not understand something. And then as you discover, as we all do, that there is something that we don't understand, be willing to use some curiosity and investigation, go out, find out what that's about.
So Richard, you're using discernment as synonymous with reflection?
No, the reflection is just the process of weighing both things. The discernment is actually taking this sword, that's what Manjushri is doing here, that's discernment. It's taking that sword of wisdom and actually dividing right view from wrong view. It's actually understanding the difference.
Okay.
Yeah, just like the difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. Same skill, that's discernment. Being able to tell the difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. Being able to tell the difference of a wrong view and a right view. That's discernment.
Okay.
The reflective acceptance is, oh, well, okay, that's what the in-breath feels like. Oh, that's what the out-breath feels like. What are the qualities? Oh, the in-breath is a little cooler, the out-breath is a little warmer. You know, that's the reflective, that's the reflection. And then the discernment is, oh, they're different.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So there is a... it was really interesting reading all these suttas that Gil chose for us, because there are a bunch of lists that are not familiar, at least they weren't familiar to me, but they're very helpful lists about the kind of qualities that you need to bring to your practice. So one of the first suttas that he had us read is Majjhima Nikaya 95, and it's called the Chanki Sutta, C-A-N-K-I, Chanki Sutta. And it's a debate, one of these debates, you know, he has these debates with the Brahmins, and so he's having this debate, and the person comes to him and says, in regard to ancient Brahmanic hymns that have come down through oral transmission preserved in the collections, talking from text, mm-hmm. right? The Brahmins have come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. What does Master Gotama say? Now with his typical, skillful approach, he doesn't just dismiss that outright. He actually goes on to explain. He takes a completely different route and will not come down to reject that. But you can tell as he talks on that he really doesn't believe, even with his own teachings, about only this is true, anything else is wrong. It's really interesting. So instead, he turns it around with a question, answers the question with a question. There are five things that may turn out in two different ways. And Gil explained those two different ways are true and false. Okay, so here's getting a little deeper into what is true. There are five things that may turn out in two different ways here and now. Here and now is a code word for the relative world. Okay. There are five things that may turn out in two different ways here and now. What five? Faith. We'll unpack that a little bit for those of you that react to faith in the way you reacted to truth. Approval, that means liking and disliking. Oral tradition, reasoned cogitation, and reflective acceptance of a view. Now, so what that means is that these five things can lead you down the wrong path, and they can lead you down the right path depending on how they're held. So we kind of get back to that holding the snake. the teachings, whatever's being read, whatever's being listened to, has to be listened to in the right way. So, what he also talks about in this one that's really interesting is how you talk about your own understanding of things. So he says, if a person has faith, he preserves truth when he says, my faith is thus. But he does not yet come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. So he's recommending to us an understanding that whatever view we hold now, that's just the view that we hold. Remember, he's talking about the here and now. So these are people that are not fully awakened. In other words, myself, I can speak for myself, and the rest of you can decide for yourself. But he's saying a preservation of the truth, we need to be able to recognize, again, there's that discernment aspect, my faith is thus. In other words, this is what I believe, or what I put my trust in. And but we don't go as far as to say, only this is true, anything else is false. Okay? So to keep that attitude, and when you speak about the Dharma with friends or with relatives or whatever, recognize that it's just relative truth. It's just the understanding that you have come to in your own practice and study, as Steve likes to say, for now. Steve likes to put that phrase at the end of a lot of teachings. So let's unpack faith just a bit. So actually, I wasn't aware of this, because in the five spiritual faculties, faith is sadda. But there are two words for faith, and these suttas use them both. So I'll channel Jeff Harden here. Jeff Harden whiteboard. This may be the term that you're more familiar with. I don't know. So this is the faith that's at the beginning of that list we read earlier. And it's the faith that's at the beginning of the five spiritual faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And that's actually the theme of Steve's day-long on the 28th, is the five spiritual faculties. So be there for that. So that one is talking about this word here, which, as we need to keep reminding ourselves, were translated first into English by Victorian English Christians. Okay? So faith, truth, have that tinge of their faith was thus. They were speaking from where they were at with their education in British schools and all of that, and they were doing the best they could. Okay, so although they translate that quite often as faith, Gill points out that, like today, Thanissaro Bhikkhu almost never translates this word as faith. I think, what did he say? 4 or 5 times in his entire, all of the suttas that Thanissaro Bhikkhu is translated, it only calls it faith 4 or 5 times. So some of the other similes are confidence, conviction, trust, and esteem, and that's in relation to a teacher. And I don't know if we'll get to the one about how we judge a teacher, but maybe that's for another day. This word pasada is really interesting, because it starts out meaning confidence, trust. The other meanings are clearness, brightness, purity, and calmness. Wow. Now, that's not an English word. I mean, to have that range of meanings, to go from confidence and trust to clearness, brightness, purity, and calmness. So we're obviously talking about much more here than some blind acceptance of what somebody else says because, you know, we like them, or we've thought about it a little bit and it seems okay, or it meets some logical test, right? And if you're ending up in a state of clearness, brightness, purity, and calmness, you know, that's not just because of some rational, shallow evaluation of something, right? That comes from actually living it. Okay. So this posada is a really interesting word to me, and I look forward to learning more about it. But just wanted to give you the range of meanings here, because when you hear the word faith, those of you that are reactive to it, again, because of some past religious upbringing or whatever, understand that this faith is a very important attribute to have. But, you know, there's an old joke about a Unitarian minister who somebody comes into him and says, "I don't believe in God," and they say, "Well, tell me about the God you don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in it either." Mm-hmm. And so same thing here with faith, where don't reject that word because of past associations. Okay. So I think you've probably heard talks on faith where there's this, it sort of evolves with time. You know, you start with a preliminary faith, and then you get, you know, what's sometimes called blind faith, and then you get a more borrowed faith because you get a teacher and they seem to really embody it, and you think, oh, maybe this could work. You know, wow, look at the way she moves through the world, look at the way she negotiates difficult situations. You know, this practice probably does have something to it. And eventually you move up to something that is coming out of your own experience. And a couple of us got together, Laura and I, another person from the class got together today, and we're discussing this thing. Our discussion led us to sort of feel like maybe what's happening as this evolves is it's actually moving from faith to something else, quite different. That even though at the end of that process, as we spiral up and come back to things, what we end up at the end is sometimes called embodied faith. It's really something more than just that. That it's actually this clearness, brightness, purity, and calmness that faith has evolved into as a result of interacting with our practice. So, I think this concept of faith is really a useful one, and I'd recommend kind of looking at it in your own life and kind of how it plays out. You know, several of you talked about, well, when I first came into practice, you know, and was just reading books and all that sort of thing, and then as I did my work, you know, as I do the meditation, actually came to an understanding for myself of what this was all about. And you know, one of the take-home messages from tonight, we won't have time to get into all of the various aspects of faith and all of that, but one of the take-home messages is that at some point, you know, this experience piece is the end game. And actually, you know, spoiler alert, after going through this whole thing, Buddha said, well, I'm this one. I'm the third one. Okay? I'm one of those people that knows something is true through personal experience, through direct experience. So when we talk about, you know, in your sitting, your formal meditation, you know, having that direct felt sense of the breath, having a direct embodied felt sense of what's going on with the body, of understanding, you know, the feeling tone of experience in a very direct way, we're recommending that for a reason. You know, that is the way that these teachings are going to move beyond some intellectual concept that's way out here in a book, or that's, you know, a little bit closer in another human being, until it's right inside. It's something that you just know. You don't have to even question it. So that's why that word faith maybe at the end of the line isn't even applicable anymore. It's something that's completely embodied, not to mention clear, bright, pure, and calm. Oh, as usual, I've bitten off more than I can chew here. I just want to touch on one more, because it's one of my favorite suttas. It's Majjhima Nikaya 7, the simile of the cloth. If a cloth were pure and bright, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why? Because of the purity of the cloth. And then, as usual, the simile goes the other way. If you have a dirty cloth, you can throw all the blue, yellow, red, and carmine dye on it that you want. It's still going to be dirty. Why? Because of the impurity of the cloth. Well, the sutta goes on to talk about direct knowledge of the imperfections of the mind. We don't like to hang out there, really. I mean, we always talk about, well, we should be with whatever it is, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and this, that, and the other thing. But the truth is, it's not real fun hanging out with ill will, anger, lust, greed. The list goes on, right? What he's recommending here is bringing that discernment that we were talking about earlier to the imperfections of the mind, to actually know that the cloth is dirty. Because what's the saying in English? You can put a makeup on a pig, or what is it? What is it?
Lipstick on a pig.
Yeah, you can put a lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig, you know. So you can put all the beautiful dyes. You know, think of all those beautiful textiles in India. Just how beautiful they are, those dyes. And, you know, somebody was saying today, most of those are made with natural leaves and insects and stuff, natural dyes. You can do all that you want to a dirty cloth, and it's not going to look good, you know. Well, you can dress up your personal life with all kinds of trappings of Buddhism, and you can have tankas, and you can have bells, and you can have malas, and all of that. But if the cloth is dirty, it's ugly. It's ugly. And to actually be willing to look at that and to see, you know, the imperfections of the mind is what leads to freedom. That's an act, that's a step that we need to take. And he laid it out in this particular thing, he laid it out like this. With direct knowledge of the imperfections of the mind, one abandons them. Thus bringing perfect confidence, sada again, in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. There's a direct movement there from sitting and looking at your anger to a complete unshakable confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. Okay. This also contains another list that I was unfamiliar with. Kind of blends two or three other lists. You know, we're not going to have time to go into it in detail, but it's actually quite inspiring. So the progression here, he kind of elaborated on that movement from direct knowledge of the imperfections of the mind, the abandoning, and then the perfect confidence. He elaborated it with this list. Faith leads to gladness. Gladness leads to rapture. Rapture leads to tranquility. That's the same progression as in the seven factors of enlightenment, right? Rapture to tranquility. Tranquility leads to pleasure, which is, I think the word there is sukha, happiness, that kind of happiness. And then pleasure leads to concentration. You've probably heard before that happiness is the proximate cause for concentration, or collectedness of mind. So faith, gladness, rapture, tranquility, pleasure, concentration. Nice place to be. And how do you get there? By hanging out with the imperfections of your mind. So don't be shy about adopting that as a practice. You know, don't overdo it. I mean, because it can get kind of depressing. But just understand that that isn't a bad place to hang out for a while, if we're willing to take that on. The other piece I love about the simile of cloth, try to end on a positive note here, is that if a cloth were pure and bright, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why? Because of the purity of the cloth. Well, remember, the cloth is the mind. Okay, so we're getting back to that purity, brightness, calmness. Those are qualities of the mind. So just know, as we've said many times here, that in this system, we're not broken. We're not... We don't have to be saved. We don't have original sin. We weren't, you know, born broken waiting for somebody to come along and bail us out, right? In this practice, the mind by nature is radiant and pure. It is only when it is visited by foreign, what is it? Outside forces. It is only when it is visited by outside forces called the defilements that we suffer. So remember that cloth. I always think of that. I always picture those bright, when I think of the simile of the cloth, those bright cloths kind of waving on a line, you know, whether it's in India or here. Think of that as the mind and how bright the mind can be when it is, when it has been cleared of these defilements. And consider that as a possible goal of practice. Any last things that need to be said, or please?
Yeah, in this purification of mind, I think we have to, one thing that's really important is patience. Those unskillful mind states have been habituated in, and many of us that are pretty old for a long period of time, and they're there very strongly. So, speaking of my own practice, there's a lot of those unskillful things I'd like to be done with, but they keep coming back, and you've got to be patient to just, there it is again, and not judge yourself. But if you just keep watching it and be patient about it, I think we can get there.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Yeah, my wife and I just did a self-retreat for... 4 nights, and we took a few Dharma talks with us, and one of them was Kamala Master's IMS Forest Refuge patience. August 2013, I think. I don't remember the date. If you go on to Dharma Seed, look up Kamala Master's and look for a talk in the last couple of years at Forest Refuge, not at IMS, but at Forest Refuge on patience. Great stuff. Yeah. Thank you. Yes?
Yeah, what are the suttas that make up the talk that you gave tonight? Like, you gave a couple of numbers.
Yeah.
Just if I wanted to, like, make sure.
The Chunky Sutta is Majjhima Nikaya 95. The simile of the snake, which also contains the simile of the raft. You know, carry the raft as long as you need it, and when you get to the other shore, put it down. And then that also contains a famous quote about, I teach one thing, suffering and the causes of suffering. Majjhima Nikaya 22.
Okay.
It's called the simile of the raft, but there's much more in it. And then the one I finished with, the simile of the cloth, is Majjhima Nikaya 7. Yeah. Vatupama Sutta.
Okay.
What was the number then?
That's Majjhima Nikaya 7. Anything else that needs to be said before we close?
What are you reading next week?
Ask Laura. I haven't gotten to him. I spent all my study time preparing this talk.
A bunch more.
And the theme is?
The path.
The path. Yeah. Week 4 is the path. The path. Oh. All right, so moving, allowing all the words to just dissolve for a moment, coming back into a relaxed body and a relaxed mind with no agenda. Just honoring this time that you have taken to listen to the Dhamma, to discuss the Dhamma with spiritual friends, to dedicate some intention and some actual action of body, speech, and mind to purifying that beautiful, radiant cloth that is the mind and heart. And recognizing that as that purification happens, the heart opens to not only our own suffering, but to the suffering of all beings in the world and in whatever other worlds there might be. So may we dedicate the positive energy that we have generated not only by our presence here tonight, but by our intention and our practice to, in some real way, relieving the suffering of all beings. May all beings be free. Thank you for your practice.